and welcome to minute 131 of season 8 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and this week I have a real treat for you guys. I have two guests that will be joining me. The first one is Christian Johnson Taylor, who is an actress, a filmmaker, producer. I'm going to have her back later this season also for another special episode. So welcome, Christian.
Thank you very much. So wonderful to be here with you.
And our other guest is Corey Johnson, who is an actor. And I didn't know this at the time, but he's in this movie. You know, so we're going to touch upon, the stuff that he did in this movie and in some other movies also. So welcome to the show, Corey.
Thank you. It's good to be here as well. Yeah, there's no reason you should know I was in the movie unless you sort of dug through the cast list for some inane reason. If you blink, you'll miss me.
Of course I did. I did. When back in the episodes that you episode you appeared in, I did discuss it, but I didn't know you at the time. Now I know you.
Exactly.
I've seen you. We've joked around a little bit.
Yes, so, we've broken bread. Yes, I hear you.
Yeah. He also has the wonderful pleasure of being one of my favorite college classmates. So. at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., way back when.
Way back when. That's a while ago. Yeah.
Right. Well, through Christian is how I got to Corey. So,
Right. Right. So many people tell me that. I only got to you through her.
And through Joe Amadei, who you've had a guest on here before, who's my distributor, is how I ended up here.
That's right. Because Joe, and I got to Joe from Steve J. Rubin.
And how is that connection?
Steve J. Rubin, on my first season, I did The Great Escape. And I found an article that Steve J. Rubin had written about it, and I contacted him. And, he was able to, he was really excited to be on the first season of my show, and he joined me. And he actually also got me in touch with the late, great David McCollum, who I interviewed on that first season also. He gave me the greatest line that I never expected to get. I knew that there was one thing. I don't know if either of you know the backstory about David McCollum and everything that happened between him and Charles Bronson.
No,
No.
They shared a wife.
Wow. I met him at the Utah Beach Museum, 2018, the first year I was there, I think, or 19. But I did not learn that fact. That's
okay. David McCollum was married to Jill Ireland. When they were filming The Great Escape, she joined him in England. Yeah. And during the course of that time that they were there, she also got to know Charles Bronson. And again, I don't know all the details, and I don't really care, and I don't need to know the details.
No.
Okay, but somehow in the end, David McCollum and Jill Ireland got divorced, and then she married Charles Bronson. So I said to myself, when I'm doing this interview, that is the one topic I'm going to stay so far away
so
from.
Clear. Yeah.
I don't need it or anything like that.
No.
And then he brought it up.
Right.
And was it? And he said that it was his great escape.
Oh, wow. Well, that's lucky then, because I was going to say, usually you look at, it's like the Animal House thing, Boone and Katie, married 1965, divorced 1969. You go, it's never the love story for the ages. Bronson and Jill Ireland was a love story for the ages.
That's right.
I think she died of cancer or something, and he nursed her through it. He never left her side,
Wow.
And so it's good, not good, but it's great to hear that, David McCallum was sort of ambivalent about the marriage to the point where when
because at that point he had been remarried for 50 years.
Well, there you go.
To his new wife.
Yeah.
And so he said that he, had he not had that whole situation not happened,
he would have never met. You see, it's amazing the way life works out.
Yeah. Sure. And he also told me stories about some of the other actors in the movie at the time. When I recorded with him, I think it was 4 years ago, there were only three of the actors from the movie that were still alive.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he was the most prominent of the three. And he unfortunately has passed since then.
Yeah.
But it was such a great opportunity to be able to speak to him. So, okay,
And how
now
did
we've
he
gone
know
off on a little
Joe?
bit of a tangent.
How did
But
he know Joe? How did he know Joe Amodei?
no, he doesn't know Joe. He knows Steve J. Rubin,
And
who
how does
had
Steve?
interviewed him. Steve, I don't know if you know who Steve J. Rubin is.
No.
Okay, so he's like an expert on James Bond. He's written like books on James Bond. He's written books on World War II movies. He's very connected in Hollywood, from what I understand. And he's actually going to be on in a few weeks also. He's going to be on this season also. I think in maybe a little bit of about a month from now or something like that.
Good.
And so Steve told me, he says, "Hey, if you're going to talk about somebody, if you're looking for other people for The Great Escape," he says, "I got my friend Joe Amodei, who named his production company after Steve McQueen's character, Virgil Hicks. The company is called Virgil Productions." So I got in touch with Joe,
I see.
and that he also joined me for 5 episodes. And I think it was about 2.5 years ago, I was visiting in the States, and Joe and I were supposed to get together and have breakfast together one morning. And then he got in touch with me the day before and said that he has to babysit his grandchildren, so he's gonna have to cancel on me. So I never got to meet him face to face. And then I continued my connection to Joe. And then when I did It's a Wonderful Life for my sixth season, so he contacted me and said that he loves that movie and he wants to also be on it. And then he got me in touch with Donna Reed's daughter,
Yes, Mary Owen.
Mary Owen.
Brilliant.
That's right.
Mary
And
Owen is who introduced me to Joe Amodei because she saw my film at a film festival, loved it, and said, Joe Amodei has to see this and distribute your film. Look at
there you
that.
go. That's
Listen,
right.
let me just say, networking in Hollywood is what it's all about. It's
That's right.
really who you know.
That's right. And my favorite line in It's a Wonderful Life. You got to remember this is that when they go back, they're showing them in high school when they open up the swimming pool.
yes,
They're
love
dancing by
that.
the swimming pool.
And
Yeah.
who's the guy who opens the swimming pool? Do you know who that is?
The kid who got the one who got jilted by her.
No, but do you know who the actor is?
No.
No.
He's Alfalfa from The Little Rascals.
Was he
Is
really?
that right? He's so cute.
Well, the guy looks at him just before he opens it. And do you remember the line he said when he
Oh.
says, they're dancing on the thing, and that court is right below a swimming pool, or right? And the swimming pool's right below there. And there's the switch. And you see the thing going up. But just before, and these are high school kids. There's no way you would have a line like this in a movie today. He walks over to him. The guy comes in. Alfalfa's in profile. And the other guy comes in behind him. And he's just like Iago. He goes, "What's the matter, Othello?" And it's just the most brilliant, literate line I've ever heard, ostensibly a child, a high school kid, utter.
That's
"What's the
awesome.
matter,
It
Othello?"
means
Yeah, it was brilliant.
he had a good education.
Yes, exactly. But you used to make movies
Well,
like that.
what's even more interesting is for that line to land with the
Yes,
audience, the
yes.
audience had to
Has to be
have
literate. Exactly,
literate that audience. And that's what I find fascinating.
And now you get actors. We could have a whole podcast about this. Actors who are mic'd, actors who don't have to, they don't have to talk any louder than this because
Yeah.
they can project on a mic all the way across. And it's like, what's connected about that? It's like being an opera singer and going, "Oh, I'm not going to project. I'm just going to sing this tone like this." The whole
John,
point of
John,
singing opera. Yeah.
John, we're taking this in a whole different direction.
I
This is
know.
not
You
I'm
said
loving this.
3
This
hours.
is great.
Let's
This is great.
get on the subject. Come on,
Okay.
Christian's going to
Well,
yell at me.
just to give you the full quote that you mentioned. So the friend comes over and says, "What's the matter, Othello? Jealous?" And he
Yeah.
goes, "Did you know there's a swimming pool under this floor? And did you know that that button behind you causes this
Causes
floor to
the
open
swing to
up?
open up. Yeah.
And did you further know that George Bailey is dancing right over that crack? And I've got the key."
It's
How
just great.
do you know that line by line?
Wait, let me
You
guess.
think I
You
know
looked
that
it
by
up on
heart?
the IMDb.
No, not at all. I looked it up on in my files.
There you go.
Yeah.
I have the scripts
You did do
from all
this
the
minute
movies that
by
I did.
minute. Yeah.
"What's
That's
the
right.
matter, Othello?" It's just the way he says it. It's so
Yes.
beautiful.
Yes.
Oh God.
That's
There's
great.
some great lines and some great moments in that movie that you can't have today.
That's true.
Correct. Correct. Again, there's still something that that I'm always shocked every time I says it when, the Mary's mother calls down and says, "What are you doing down there?" And she says, "He's making violent love to me."
Love to me.
And again,
Right.
nowadays, that's a
Right.
completely different connotation than it
Connotation.
was
Exactly.
in 1946.
Exactly.
You know, because it always shocked me that that's what they're, what?
Nothing,
That's what
nothing
saying
I don't want him to do, you know. Even that would get her in trouble.
Yeah, probably.
Anyway.
Probably. All right. So let's talk a little bit about Saving Private Ryan at this point.
Let's delve.
That's right. So minute 131 begins with Mike moving some rocks and ends with Miller looking up for help from above. So we basically finish things on Friday with, you know, the men realizing that the tanks are getting closer and that they're hoping that they're going to come down this little street. And, you know, we talked a little bit about it on Friday that, you know, Tom Sizemore's character, Mike, is, you know, trying to do all that he can while he's in this ditch to you know, keep himself as hidden as possible. And he starts moving some rocks, which I just think is really funny because, you know, the whole ground is shaking. So moving a little rock here or there is probably not going to make much of a difference.
Yep. But the thing about it was, is in that war, you would think, man, how many pairs of socks can they give us? And what are we going to do with this tar, you know? And yet they made sticky bombs because there's a reason they were called the greatest generation. They were the most resourceful people out of necessity and from birth because, you know, somebody said, look, we want you to join the army. And they said, it's going to be hard. It's going to be, you're going to work. You're going to this. And they went, They didn't hear anything they hadn't been through. And then they said, we'll give you three squares and a cot. And they went, excuse me? They said, we'll give you three squares and a cot. Most of them had never eaten three meals a day. Some of them had never slept in a bed. And so they said that, and they said, I'm in. Where do I sign? Nothing anyone could do to them was going to put them off. And so this was such a resourceful group of people that, you know, I mean, that moment of him moving the rocks, Tom Hanks looking up, you know, it's just the idea that you go, he's hoping for a higher power. He's praying for a higher power. And the genius of Steven Spielberg is you never expect what ends up happening to happen.
Correct.
You think it's going to be a sticky bomb. You think it's going to be some slip up. Somebody's going to save the day. And you don't expect the deus ex machina, literally a deus ex machina that, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course.
Theater person. Course. Right. It, you know, because it is a machine acting like a god. I mean, you know, and it just, when the planes come overhead, it's like the wave of relief that went through the audience at that moment. You can't, you could tell that people knew this was the end for these guys, you know?
Right.
You know, sure. I have a different take on the moving of the rock. So, you know, the saying, there are no atheists in foxholes. And I've talked to a lot of these guys who were, no matter where they were, trying to hide, where they're moving rocks or digging ditches deeper or putting, you know, branches over their foxhole. Because they will actually admit now at 98 or 100 years old that of course we were scared.
They were terrified.
Of course we were terrified. We'd be stupid to think we were not scared.
Right.
Well, if they you know, weren't scared, then most of them wouldn't have had a problem talking about it afterwards. You know, that's part of the reason why most of them kept it bottled up, because they didn't want to show everyone that, you know, that they were actually in a situation where they were scared.
Terrified for their lives. Yeah. Reliving. You don't want to relive that. You want to forget that.
Yeah.
Correct.
I mean, and the reason, let me just say that I know these things. I mean, I'm here because the film that I made, it's called The Girl Who Wore Freedom, and it's the story of D-Day, but from the perspective of the French. And I started working on that film back in 2016. So it's now 2025. I've been, you know, working on this film for 9 years now. I continue to talk and work with World War II veterans as well as currently serving soldiers. And so I have a unique perspective on, you know, this film simply because I've spent so much time with these guys. And, you know, one of the reasons that I've heard that they don't talk about things as well is two reasons. One, they've told me when they try, people don't want to listen. Their eyes glaze over and they don't really seem that interested.
I find that so shocking, because if someone were to tell me these stories, I would love to hear them.
Yeah. But you have to understand that the wars we've grown up with aren't absolute. They're wars of choice.
Correct.
You know, we with this was an either or situation. You know, the World War II and World War One. I mean, World War One, basically, they called it the war to end all wars. They used to call it the Great
The
War
Great War, exactly.
Before we had to number them, do you know?
Correct.
And the only reason, I mean, this is what's dangerous about the time we're living in, is one of the only reasons we haven't had another war is because of things like the United Nations and the Marshall Plan
deterrence.
and deterrent, right. But, you know, this was an absolute. This war was either we win or we lose. It wasn't, well, we can sort of back out and there'll be honor in this and, you know, we'll let them go. And it wasn't that. There was no intent. Germany and Japan had no intention of losing. They had no intent. They were in it for, you know, absolute. Everybody was all in on this poker hand.
That's right.
So,
for sure.
Yeah, it wasn't, you don't see like what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Vietnam, even to a degree what happened in Kuwait with Kuwait. I mean, that was an overwhelming military firepower that completely destroyed another country. And yet we still said, okay, all right, you can have this and you can keep those and you can do this, because it was as important to keep that country in with a semblance of governance instead of going in and, you know, it's like the Pottery Barn, you break it, you bought it. Instead of going in and governing that country ourselves, that wasn't what... especially at the time, but that wasn't what we were supposed to be about. But in World War II, we entered that war because freedom and democracy, freedom first, but democracy to a degree, the freedom for people to choose the way they live their lives had to be saved, you know? And
well,
so-
and not only that, we were all on the same page with that idea.
Yeah. There were no separate agendas.
There was no, I mean, everybody, it was very simple. It was black and white. It was, we were
right.
all on the same
right.
page, not
right.
just, you know, the Americans, but the Americans no. and all the allies. And there
right.
was one single objective and we were all on the same page. And ever since World War II, that has been different. Now,
yes.
to address what you were saying, that it's hard to imagine that people don't want to listen.
Yeah.
That's because you are in a very niche audience, and the people that are listening to this probably in that very niche audience. And I have the people that watch my film, niche audience, you know?
The other thing, Christian, is your movie, your documentary is telling a story that I believe at first Americans don't feel like they need to hear. And then it's only when you listen to it and you go, God, this is amazing. I didn't know this, you know?
Right. We think we're thankful.
That's what I felt. When I started your movie, that's what I thought. I said to myself, I never even thought to even, you know,
consider that.
It never even crossed my mind to consider the fact
that
the French people would, you know, 80 years on still be so happy about the fact that, you know, that the Allies showed up. And again, anyone who's seen Band of Brothers, you know that they have all the parades both in Holland and also in France when they're going through there and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But that's at the moment. You know, but here we're talking 80 years later, it still resonates.
Yeah.
And that's just,
So for those of you that are listening, the film, my film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom, you can find out information about that on thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. There's a 4-minute trailer right when you get there and you can click on it. It's actually John's voice, who's the narrator there. He was the very first person that I called when I had the idea to make the film. You know, like I said, we've known each other since college, and, you know, I knew he had this history with World War II films. He's a phenomenal narrator and an actor. And, you know, of course, he had this connection to Tom Hanks, and I was hoping that there would be some way I could connect or have support or whatever. But mostly I wanted to know, do you think this is a good idea? And in the end, what the crux of this story is that, you know, the French have this way of being truly grateful and showing their gratitude that's completely different than anything that Americans have ever done. And
grateful and gracious, because there's nothing diminutive about them being this grateful. It's a celebration of their gratefulness, which is, you know, a tribute to their culture.
And it's not just the French, however. I've learned it's also the people in Luxembourg, and it's also the people in Holland. It's the people in, you know, Belgium. It's or Yeah, it's the people in the Netherlands. I have traveled all over, and it is the same because when you have been oppressed for that long, it's 4 years. Most people don't know their history enough to know that it was
No.
4 years. It's like the high school or college. When you've been oppressed that long and under that thumb, and all of a sudden you're liberated from that, that gratitude is so deep. We've never been occupied in the US, so we do not know that kind of. So when I saw that gratitude for freedom that had been passed down from, parents to children and or grandparents to grandchildren, I was stunned. And I thought, we have to look through the French eyes and we have to understand what true gratitude really looks like. And what I learned was
Yeah.
as they listened to the veterans and as they spent time with the veterans, I watched it change the veterans. I watched it be like the fountain of youth for them. They started out the trip, old and kind of, I don't know, rickety. But by the time they were done, they were dancing. They were happy.
Yeah, for
The
sure.
people
And
listened.
it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is people don't listen. And so that's why veterans didn't share. And the other reason that they don't share is because it is so traumatic that to repeat or share any of that stuff is so incredibly painful. And so now today, we are learning that by talking, it is the healing, and that's the way to heal PTSD. But
Yeah.
back then, nobody knew that. And so
Yep.
everything was stuffed down. And so,
It's the American way as well. I mean, you just sort of held it in.
Have you either of you seen the movie Memorial Day from 2012 with
No.
James Cromwell? So it's a movie about it takes place in numerous timelines, right? It's about this soldier fighting in Iraq who is remembering a day I don't know 10 years earlier where he was at his grandparents' farm and he found a chest filled with World War II memorabilia when this kid was 13. And so he wants to hear the stories from his grandfather as to what happened during World War II. So the grandfather is played by James Cromwell. And so basically, I'm not going to give away the entire movie, but the idea is that the grandfather says it's too painful, but I'm willing to tell you three stories. Hey, pick three items from the chest, and I will tell you their stories. And again, it's just amazing because we see stuff that happened in World War II. We see stuff that's happening in Iraq. We see this connection between a grandfather and a 13-year-old kid, about the whole idea of, having to find ways to open up and tell your story. You might want to hold it in, but if you hold it in for too long, you're not going to be able to pass on those stories so that people won't know what you went through. So I actually just rewatched it yesterday because, after talking to you the other day, Christian, it reminded me that I wanted to rewatch that movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, I tell you, it is really important. And if there are any veterans listening to this podcast, I say this all the time. It is crucially important that if you have served and you have never shared your story, even if you've never been in actual combat, it is really important that you share your story, particularly with your family. And the reasons are that civilians don't understand anything about the military. They don't understand the questions to ask you, but they do want to know. They genuinely want to know, but they don't understand anything about the military. So where do they start? And the thing is, once you begin to share, it draws you closer. And if you have been in combat, it does begin to heal. And it does pass down the stories to those that are younger than you. So, please do share your stories, learn from this conversation, and don't hold them in.
Yeah, for sure. That's great. All right, let's continue talking about Saving Private Ryan.
Yes, let's do. Okay, so he's moving the
Actually, you know
rock.
what? You know what? I'm even gonna I'm gonna divert a little bit also because Corey, you were in this movie, so let's through the course of this week, maybe we'll talk each day a little bit about, you know, your experiences when you made this movie. But the first question is how did you get the part? Do you remember?
Same way I got everything else. It was sheer unmitigated luck. One of my professors at college said there are three things that make an actor: talent, luck, and perseverance. And the interesting thing he said was any two and you can make it. But if you've only got one, you won't make it. I always thought I was reasonably talented. And it was just luck that I was in the right place at the right time when they were casting it, because, you know, they obviously a lot of things were cast in Los Angeles. And in the 80s, 70s and 80s, they used to come over here and cast.
Wait a second. You can't just say come over here. John,
London.
John is living in London.
London.
After college, he decided to go to RADA, which is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
No, I went to Central.
Oh, Central. Central Academy
School.
Of
Central.
Yeah, Central right. Academy of Dramatic
Speech
Arts.
And drama. Yeah.
And he's lived there ever since. So that's where he is.
Right.
And by the way, he said he thought he was reasonably talented. He's one of the most talented actors I've ever met. He's phenomenal. And so let's just set that record straight.
So anyway, I was lucky and I persevered because the lack of talent was palpable in my I just happened to be in the right place at the right time when they were casting some of the smaller roles. And I think, you know, I'm a big believer in luck, in the sense of people always think, look, you know, you say if it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Luck is luck. You determine that it's bad luck, you know, but it's like, you know, God closes a door, he opens a window. There's always something else going on. It's up to you to be able to see it. And sometimes we're so mired in what we think we want to be or what we think we need that it's difficult to see what it is we're being offered. I never had that problem. Being an American over here, I was always grateful to sort of be working. And it's not like I did a lot of work, but I did enough work to where I could live a reasonably, you know, happy life. But anyway, I was offered a very small part in Saving Private Ryan, and I was booked for a couple of weeks. And
now, didn't they film it over in London?
In Ireland.
Yeah. And so did they cast the leading roles in LA and then smaller roles they cast in over there?
You know, that's what I was saying. They in the 70s and 80s
Makes
they
sense.
Used to come over here with, I mean, there were all kinds of movies that came over here. Yanks, John Schlesinger's movie, came over here
with
after
Richard
that.
Gere.
I think they have Richard Gere, and it came over here and he filled out some of the smaller roles. It's like a who's who of American Canadian actors in London. They'd film in London, they'd film in France because it was cheaper to do that than to film in America. And then gradually London and Europe became expensive. And so they moved to Eastern Europe and, you know, Czechoslovakia, Poland, even Germany. I shot a movie in Germany in 92 that took place during the Cold War. So I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and I got cast in this movie. I'm pretty sure I auditioned for one of the main characters, and just it didn't work out. So I was offered this one. Now, we were there for a couple of weeks. I remember we flew in on a Saturday into Dublin and then drove two hours and change to Rosslare Harbor, where it was being filmed. And as I remember, our bed and breakfast was sort of within 5 or 10 minutes walk of where the set was. And you could go and look and see, they would have these huge, what are they called, Christian? The tank busters, where they'd have the huge
a hedgehog.
The hedgehog. They have these huge steel things.
The Czech hedgehogs.
And you'd look at them and it'd be like, at the end of the day, it was like, wow. That just looks amazing. And the sea is washing in. And then this runner would go up and stand under one, lift it up and walk it up the beach. And you think, okay, that's just another illusion shattered. But I remember I had a costume fitted or something, and you show up on Monday and, or I don't know if we showed up on Monday, but what happened was is someone called our hotel and said, yeah, we're not going to get to you guys today. I was like, okay. But tomorrow we'll get you in and we'll sort of talk you through some stuff. So tomorrow we went in, and again, you know, we were there for like a few hours in the morning. We met a few people. I remember not meeting, but I saw Tom Sizemore, and he was sitting like in his trailer or something. And I just went up to him and I said, "Hey, Tom, I'm Corey. I've got a small part in the movie. I just wanted to say hi and introduce myself." And he, like, because Tom Sizemore was not sort of, you know, the easiest person to sort of approach. He's a very intense man. And he just kind of looked at me like, "I don't know you. Why are you standing in front of me?" And he went, "Uh-huh." And I just left. And I remember like, okay. But all of these guys.
He doesn't seem like that.
I'll tell you another story about him.
He was given an ultimatum by Spielberg about this movie.
Well, he was told he was going to have to submit urine tests.
That's right.
To make sure.
Wait, I haven't heard this.
And if he fails on any of them, they're gonna recast his role and reshoot every one of the scenes.
They were gonna recast him. Yeah.
So he did drugs. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. Yeah, he was notorious. I want to say it was Heat, but I don't believe he did another movie with Robert De Niro. Robert De Niro really rated him as an actor. He thought he was great. And Robert De Niro was friendly with his family. He knew his mother. And Tom was brought up in Detroit, I believe. And one of his brothers, I want to say, died in Vietnam. Hmm. I could be wrong. But he had sort of a rough childhood. And was, you know, I mean, self-anesthetizing. And his mother was very worried and called Robert De Niro and said, "You've got to help him." And so they intervened. Robert De Niro and his own mother said, "You've got to get help," and got him clean for a period of time. And this was right around Private Ryan. I think it was after Heat.
He came out in 95.
Right. Yeah. It may have been before Heat, but I think it was after Heat. And then he was clean for Private Ryan. Now, by the time I did another movie that was awful in 2002, right around the time Tom was shooting Relic, and he was determined that he could do this movie, and he had like scraggly hair and a full beard when he was doing Relic, and he said, no, I can do it. I'll just shave the beard off. And they said, "You've got the," he said, "they'll put a fake beard on, a wig." And it was like, dude, no, you know, you can't. And so there was an idea that maybe, you know, he's not sort of living in the real world. You know, now I saw him years ago at a Comic-Con, and he was giving a speech. He was talking to people, and he was very forthcoming because he had had the whole Heidi Fleiss thing, and he had gone to prison. And he told a story about being in prison. He said, "All these guys who were my friends, none of them came to visit me in prison except for Tom Hardy."
Interesting.
Tom Hardy is one of the I'm probably going to ruin his reputation, and if he ever sees me, he'll punch me hard in the face. One of the nicest, sweetest guys, really. He's just a lovely man, and very he deserves what he's getting because he's been through a lot, and again, very, very, very talented, very focused, very single-minded on what he does, but didn't let his whatever his demons were that were pursuing him, he did not let them get him. You know, which is, I mean, it's a struggle. The struggle is real. But anyway.
Anyway, so you're saying that Spielberg.
Tuesday, we show up and we meet a few people at the time. And then at lunch, they go home. We're not going to get to you today. Wednesday, same thing. And we used to go back to this bed and breakfast we were staying in. And they would literally say to us for dinner, we'd have 10 or 12 of us sitting around this table. And they'd go, "What do you have?" And it was like, "Well, what have you got?" "Well, we've got fish, we've got a lovely salmon, and we've got chicken, and there's some steak, lovely Irish beef." We say, "Yeah, we're all American. You know? I'll have a steak, 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 steak." By the end of the week, we just didn't call it dinner. We called it our beefing because it was just, no one was ordering fish or chicken. We were getting this Irish steak. It was sirloin. It was gorgeous. So, you know, I could have put on 20, 30 pounds just by having dinner at this place. Fortunately, Friday rolled around, Thursday rolled around, and they said, "Look, we're definitely going to get to you tomorrow. With any luck, we're going to shoot you out tomorrow." And I was booked for 2 weeks. I was going, you know, I'm here next week. They said, "Well, we'll see what happens." So sure enough, we start the sequence where the ships land on the beach, and all these guys come running forward. and machine guns, squibs are going off, and bombs are going off. And I can remember looking at this sequence and thinking, you got to be kidding me. There were like Irish Army regulars who were running along the beach who knew what they were doing. There were amputees who were like carrying fake arms and looking around. And I was just like, this is just madness. It's chaos. And I could sit there and laugh about it, but that was exactly what he wanted to capture. And correct, he did brilliantly. You know, he
did. So you're saying, brilliantly. So how much would you say when you saw the film was what you saw on the beach versus CGI that was done in post?
There was no, as far as I know, there was very little CGI. CGI in the terms of you might have tweaked the sound. CGI in terms of, I can't speak to whether or not the blood was fake. I know that 99 times out of 100, when you see someone bleeding in a movie today, it's probably fake.
Right.
Okay. So I can't speak to the CGI. I do remember, this could have been Thursday, I'm not certain, they had tramps buried in the sand. And these soldiers would run over the tramps, and as they ran over them, they would trip something that would flip the tramp, and they would be flung into the air. But they had to know how to trip the tramp.
Right.
And one of these guys, either someone tripped it and he didn't step on it, he was just off it, and this tramp came up and literally broke his leg.
Whoa.
And so they're going like, the guy's screaming on the beach. There are people standing around him. There's an ambulance.
It's perfect. That's what we want.
There's an ambulance driving up the beach, and then this AD pulls out a megaphone and goes, okay, people, that's lunch. And I was just like, get me off this beach, man. This is just, but you see, that's the beauty of it is even that gave me an understanding of the absolute chaos of what that must have been. And we had this in United 93. The fact that those guys couldn't leave. They couldn't go, just give it, hang on, we're going to have some lunch. Just give us a minute. Give us a minute. When they were in it, they were in it, you know? And some of them, the ones who didn't die, it was hours, like a day or 2 days before they could go and look up and catch their breath and go, okay, that's behind us. Where do we go now?
That's right. What's
our next play? Where are we going?
And let me tell you this, when some of them came off, and even the ones that came off, you know, day two, day three,
yeah,
they came off and they walked right into the graves, and they moved those, you know, not long after they realized we can't have these temporary graves right here at the beachhead. Right. And so they did move them to St. Mary Glees. But I mean, for a while, these guys were walking off the beach straight into these temporary graves.
Right.
I mean,
horrific. Oh, it's horrific. It must have been horrific.
Playing the radio man. So, you know, you didn't have to run across the beach.
And then, No. I was discovered where I was.
Meaning it's not that we're going to find, you know, if you go through a fine toothpin, you know, through the movie, we're not going to be able to find Corey Johnson running across the beach.
No, you won't. That's what I'm saying. They came to me because Tom Hanks's brief was you have to get to the beach. You have to what did he say? You have to report the condition is. In other words, they're going to be landing somewhere. We're going to blow this thing open and we're going to roll the ships in. And so that's what you mentioned, a scene when Tom Sizemore's helmet flips off.
Mm-hmm.
I remember watching them shoot that scene.
Oh, wow.
And I remember, I was standing just behind the camera, and I remember going, that probably wasn't a good take. And then Spielberg just really calmly said, okay, nice. He said, Tom, remember when you do such and such and this and that, and keep your voice going because there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of noise. Okay. And let's just do one more. And he does one more, and it's absolutely flawless. And he says, okay, great, we got it. That was his security. He knew the one with the helmet coming off was the one he was going to use. I believe that. I believe he saw that, and he didn't want to say anything because A shot like that is a miracle. You have to understand. When something like that happens, occurs, and you manage to get it on film and it's in focus, you go, please, God, please, God, please, please let there not be a hair in the gate. Please let it be in focus. Please, all this. But you have to still go, let's get one more for security in case it doesn't work.
Yeah, because you never know. You can look out, you know, that's the thing I learned as a director. You can look at what's happening with the actors and outside of the camera.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's acting and all of the things you see outside of the camera can be flawless.
Perfect, right.
And then something with the audio or something with, you know, a hair in the camera or something.
Or
with,
a bird craps on someone's shoulder.
Something like that. And you get in post and you're like, oh my gosh, it ruined that perfect take.
And I don't have anything else.
And I don't have a backup. Yeah. You always have to shoot it again. Yeah.
And that you see, this is the brilliant thing about Steven Spielberg. I think I've worked with him once. So, you know, and I didn't get to chat with him much. I just got to say hello a little bit, but watching him work, you realize he knows what he's going to do. He knows what he wants to do. He doesn't have to tell anyone, this is what I know. He just gets people who do their jobs. And when he says, there were sometimes half a dozen cameras running at the same time on this beach. You know, there were handheld cameras. There were all different kinds of cameras. You know, all of them, Janusz who shot it. Scrubbed lenses, you know, really, really stark, no coatings, no, just scrubbed lenses and looking as raw as possible, looking as much like a cinematic version of a human eye, nothing protected, nothing kind of, there was nothing, you know, when they put a coating on a lens, it gives you the luxury of being able to go and sit back. This, when you watch Private Ryan, you're going, it's like you watch it with a little bit of horror. You know, not like you watched Apocalypse Now.
Or a lot of horror, if you're somebody like me.
But, well, the thing about it is there were so many other things at play.
Right there. Yeah.
There were so many other things at play with that movie. I watched the first sequence, Private Ryan came out when we were in, I believe we were in Morocco shooting The Mummy. We may have just been back. I think we were just back. We were in London. It was like July 98. And it must have either just come out or something, June 98, the producers got a copy of it, and we watched it, and I'm sitting with a guy who is a South African actor who was wounded in, you know, a war in South Africa, and literally watched the first bit of that movie like, this is a big guy, watched the first bit of that movie like this. And I didn't know if he was praying or just couldn't watch it, but he couldn't talk about it. Didn't come out going, man, that was realistic. Man, that was this. He just went and just, it was like, it was too much. It was too much. It's amazing for a man who, I mean, I don't know how he knows war, who never didn't serve, didn't, you know, wasn't really come close to it, but had no fear, no trepidation about asking what would be really hard questions about something and literally saying, I am not a guy who knows. I am a guy who wants to know what you know. I want to tell this story. I believe this. I want to tell this story. I need to tell your story, and I need you to tell it to me so I can tell it to people. You know?
Well, and I've learned from veterans, I've learned a lot of veterans say about Saving Private Ryan when they went the first time that it was that movie that got them to start talking, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard that often, but John, listen, you've been like going off on a tangent, so I'm going to pull you right back on.
Please keep doing that. And tangent is my middle name.
I know. I just want you to answer the question really simply.
Right.
So when you had your time, your moment in the sun, you basically were just sitting on a beach. They put you on a beach. Tell me exactly what you had to do when it was your time to shoot. Okay. I want to know from the beginning to the end, what was your day of shooting like? Did it take one day, 2 days? Like, give me what you had to do, please.
Half a day.
Okay.
Half a day.
half a day. What'd you have to do?
We got to my bit because he would shoot it incrementally. He'd shoot the bit up to where Tom Hanks gets blown, his eardrum blown out or something, and he can't hear, and his hand is shaking, and he's looking around, and he sees a guy walking with his arm going, oh, there it is, picks up an arm and goes off, like he's got only one arm now, but he picks up his arm and goes off. Other guys just screaming, you know, this, that, and the other. And he finally gets together and puts his helmet on. And so they shoot that sequence, and then they shoot the next sequence where he runs to the foxhole, and he buries himself in the foxhole, and he finds his guys. And that's when Sizemore rolls over and says something to him. And then he leans across and grabs me because he's getting the information. Where are we? We're supposed to be here, but we're not here. How do you know we're not here? Because these guys are supposed to have come in and done that, but they haven't. So that's why he's saying, you know, cat F, dog one is not open. It's not open, meaning they're going to bring these ships in and they're going to back up on the shoreline where they're going to be sitting ducks for these things. They're saying, hold them off. We haven't blown things, you know, up yet. So that's where I come in. I'm the one who's going, now we've got these guys come in and these guys are here and everything's moving through. So keep them coming. I'm the contact with the shore. I'm the shore party, you know, and they're all, you know, so he's calling me shore party, grabs me, pulls me over. He says, say again, dog one is not open. I repeat, dog one is not open. Throws me back. They find it's a shore party, grabs me again, says another line. Now, the whole time I'm sitting there, and all I've got to do is literally, I'll show it to you inside. I'm just rolling like this with a thing in my head going, and rolling out. And the second time I did it, I had two absolutely enormous guys. I would roll out and reach my hands out. They would grab me, pull me out. Right next to me was the dummy with blood bags just right in the face. And they'd roll it in. Tom Hanks would grab, short party. My face is blown open. Blood's coming out of it. He just goes, I mean, that was like something out of a Hammer horror film.
That's right. Because the face is just caved in. I actually always thought that was CGI. I didn't realize it was a dummy.
No.
Well, so wait a second. Dummy. Wait. You're going too fast. Okay,
that's
wait.
Not for someone who knows the movie.
It's never boring with me.
So, okay, so you're acting, and so the two guys that pulled you out, they pulled you out, stuck a dummy in, and then
there
the
was a dummy next to me. It was a dummy next to me in the foxhole, ready to go, just out of frame. I would roll in, lean in. I did it again, rolled in, lean in. The third time I was supposed to do it, before the third time, they reach in because Tom Hanks is talking to Tom Sizemore. So the camera goes from here to here, from here to here. And then they pull me out, replace me with the dummy. It comes back to here. Tom Hanks is here. The dummy's here, gushing blood. Tom Hanks grabs the thing. The dummy slides down. He slid down and slid away. They just pulled him by the legs and pulled him out.
I see.
And then Tom Hanks picks up the radio and realizes.
So Kedav, shore party. The radio's dead. Yeah. And so they're screwed.
And that's what they did. I mean, I realized, like, I could never watch Saving Private Ryan. And I had a friend that was a director, and he's like, you were going to watch this. And I was like, I can't. It's just, this is when I was doing directing. And he's like, you cannot do this film unless you watch Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers. So you're going to watch this, and we're going to watch it at slow speed. And you're going to realize that this is movie magic. And so he did. He slowed everything down for me. And I realized, oh my gosh, those are dummies. And so I learned that every single one of those things that exploded, like lost their legs or whatever, were dummies.
Well, some of them were amputees. Some of them had lost an arm previously, and they just were hired to look around. They had a shredded kind of sleeve that was bloody, and they'd find a piece of arm, and they go, "Yeah, this'll do," and walk away. You know,
wow.
Because that's what happened.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm saying. Some of these guys were like, you know, what's his name, Upham, where they were just so terrified and screaming, and some of them just had no awareness of the significance of the fact that their arm was no longer attached to their bodies.
Yeah, it's kind of like shock.
Oh, complete shock. Yeah.
So how many takes?
Oh, I don't remember doing more than a handful. This is the other thing I was going to say. 20, 30 takes, that ain't him. 2, 3, 4, that's him.
Hmm.
That's him. That's what he does. He goes.
And so then you were done.
I'm not going to waste my... No. Then we had another thing where he wanted a bunch of actors to say, I can't remember the line. He wanted us to say a line, a sequence of lines, like I can't remember. I'll just make some. I mean, it could be like Tom Hanks on Shore Party, Cat F, Dog One is not open. Repeat, Dog One is not open. Okay, say that like you're freaking. Cat F, Dog One is not open. You know, we're all saying this then. And some of the guys, God love them, some of the guys can't do it. They can't say it. They're either Irish Army guys or they're you know, just really actors who are used to playing nice people, and they don't get what this situation is. And so I popped off and I said my line. He says, do it once more. And I said it again. And he goes, and I'm literally, I was having pictures taken with my dummy. I've got a picture somewhere of me and my dummy with the face blown off. And
hey,
so
I'm hugging.
I don't know where it is. Katrina took so many of so much of my memorabilia. It's scary. I'm hugging my dummy and they're taking pictures. And he says, can you say that line? And I put the dummy down and I said, da-da-da-da. And he said, say it another time. Say it like this. He says, okay, give me one where you're doing this and let it come. And he looked at the AD and he said, this guy's a good actor. Can we get him in something else? And I picked up the dummy and I went like this. I just looked at the dummy and I went, you got to ask this guy because I don't think I'm going to be in the rest of the movie. You know,
that's awesome.
Yeah,
well,
that's good. I mean, that's the stuff you remember. That's the stuff you remember, though.
Is that why you got in Band of Brothers?
No. I got in Band of Brothers, same thing. I auditioned for another role and didn't get it because, you know, they were casting who they cast. And it was beautifully cast, Band of Brothers. And, you know, I was just
That's so frustrating that, like, he can say that. So Steven Spielberg said that to you?
Yeah, but I'm sure he said, look, there was an armorer on the set who was on Band of Brothers as well. And I worked with him on something else as well as Private Ryan. And, He would, you know, say, you know, okay, you've got a sidearm. Here it is. It's no bullets. See, the chamber's empty. Click that and that. And he showed me now, when you hold it, because they used to just, they wouldn't train you. Private Ryan, they were the first movies where you'd really did this training.
That's right.
In the 90s was where, you
That's
know,
right.
they really did.
Well, Dale Dye.
Dale Dye.
Company
Dale Dye. Exactly. So they would show us how to do. And Simon Atherton, I know it was a stock line. He'd come up and he'd say, you know, he'd see me one morning and say, hello, Corey. And I'd say, hi, Simon. How are you? He said, very good, very good. And I said, how's everything going? It's a chat about this. Here's your gun. And this is, you could click it like that. And I'd say, so it's all ready to go. I'd say, Simon, thank you so much. And he goes, it's all right. Can't do enough for a good actor. And I know he said that to everybody. You know, it was just his stock line, like saying, top of the morning to you. Can't do enough for a good actor. And that's what he would say. It made you feel great. You know, but that's why they're good at what they do, because they make you feel like you're
very talented. You are talented, and Steven Spielberg was right, and you should have been given more roles.
Well, no, you know, I mean, I did what I did. I love doing what I did. I thought it was great what I did. And you know, that was me done, and I went home like the next day, which was great. I was a week in Ireland, you know, and I was in Private Ryan.
And you got to have all that meat.
And I got to eat beef, all that beef. I had my beefing. I haven't had a similar beefing in my life. I haven't ever had that much beef in 1 week in my life.
All right.
I'm telling you, I think I bought a heart attack. I'm not sure.
Well, you're still here, so that's already good.
I am still here, yes.
Yeah, so and we are talking 27 years, so I don't think if God forbid you get a heart attack,
I'm okay.
It's not going to be frozen.
And congratulations for answering the questions directly. I'm very thankful.
You're so lucky.
All right. So because we've talked about so many other fascinating things, we're just going to quickly go through this minute, you know, just of everything that's going on. If there's anything you guys want to point out as we go through it, feel free. So the scene changes, and then we have Henderson and Mellish getting their gun ready, and then Henderson notices that Mellish is chewing gum, and he looks at him and goes, "You got any more of that?" And he basically halves it and gives it to him and puts it in his mouth, which I've always found pretty disgusting. But you know, as we mentioned, you know, these guys don't know what's really in store for them. You know. How much longer they're going to be alive. So you might as well enjoy it while you can. You know?
I have a lot to say about this, actually. So that scene to me depicts what I believe I see from the time that the German soldier, they're trying to decide if the German soldier is going to live or die.
Steamboat Willie.
Mm-hmm. All the way through to when, you know, kind of the battle here in Rommel is, you know, calmed down or whatever. And it's this whole idea where you see them, you know, you see the fight and you see them getting mad at each other, and you see Tom Hanks, you know, solving the, you know, question of what he does in real life. And, you know, you see them finding Ryan, and you see them being told that, you know, his brothers are gone, and him saying, I'm not leaving. I'm staying right. with my guys. And you
I'm see staying with the only family I have left.
Right. And you see, and then him saying, then begin telling his stories of remembering his brothers. And, you know, you, and then you see this splitting of the gum. And what you see there is you see this brotherhood that has been developed, this close-knit family,
right,
sharing
right.
of the gum like that. That's a family right. thing that you do. You know, yeah. it's we share the same germs. That's right. what it is. And they did. They shared the same germs. They
right.
they are that close. And when I watched all of that, it reminds me so much of what I have heard from the veterans for such a long time. And when I see them together, and it doesn't even have to be ones that have served together. And I have seen ones that have served in the same units be together, and it is so special. But I've seen ones that come together in Normandy that have never seen each other, didn't know each other, but they served in the same war. Mm-hmm. They can speak the same language. They have the same understanding of this period of time. They saw the same things, and
right.
they are instantly bonded. Just right. like brothers. And then you come down. I haven't mentioned this yet, but I have two sons that are in the military. And in my film, if you watch The Girl Who Wore Freedom, which you can, if you're in the US, you can find it on Amazon, Apple TV, Vudu, et cetera. If you watch that, you'll see that my oldest son, Hunter, was in the Army at the time. He's now in the Navy. And my younger son is in the Army as a mechanic. So I spent a lot of time with both of them. And, what I see with them is the exact same thing. It's happening today. They spend time in the field or in, you know, these field exercises living with these guys. And that develops, that sense of brotherhood and family develops, and they fight like they hate each other and they want to kill each other. And then the next thing you know, they're their best friends. I mean, it's crazy. I don't understand it, but it other than the fact, you know, and the sense of humor, like there's military humor that is absolutely horrific. Like seriously, if the real world heard what the military humor is, I mean, they would be in such trouble, but that's the mm-hmm. way that they kept themselves sane. And so I talked to Hunter, who's fought in Afghanistan, and he explained this to me that, you know, this is their tribe.
That's right.
This is their tribe. And what happens when a lot of soldiers leave and get out and they finally have understood this is that the rate of alcoholism or drug use or even suicide is because they've lost their tribe.
That's right.
And you hear this from Sebastian Younger. I don't know if you've heard of the book Tribe, Homecoming and Belonging. But if you haven't read that book, that is a phenomenal explanation of exactly what I'm talking about. And he was embedded with Restrepo, actually.
Yeah.
Joe Amade contributes to that movie. Restrepo is a great movie. You should talk about that.
Joe's connected to Restrepo? Wow, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Joe distributes Restrepo. And so, Sebastian Younger, he's also a good friend with Sebastian Younger. You could probably get him on here. But he was embedded with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he then learns afterwards, like what their life is like. And he learns about this when they get out and how lost they are. And so he writes this book, Tribe, Homecoming and Belonging, and talks about, you know, what happens to them. And that's what I see here.
Wow.
This
okay.
is their tribe.
Again, you've hit the nail on the head there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I talked about it a few weeks ago. When, you know, right after Miller tells Ryan, you know, why he's there. And then we mm-hmm. see some of the other guys standing around. And one of them goes, hey, what's going on? And he goes, Ryan lost his brother. And then he goes, which one? And he goes, all of them. Now, the thing that I picked up from that is, okay, Ryan's with these guys a day or two. So he's, you know, because remember, Mendelsohn told us that, you know, that they grabbed Ryan and an officer grabbed Ryan and put him in this makeshift unit. So these are not necessarily guys that he's known for a long time, but you know, they're together this day, 2 days, whatever it is. They've formed this bond, and therefore
he already knows how many brothers he's gotten.
That's right.
It doesn't matter.
Right. These guys already know that he's got, you know, three brothers that are also fighting in this war. And, you know, so it, you know, just a little line like that. And again, that's the whole idea of Band of Brothers.
Yep. I mean,
Stephen Ambrose wrote the book, and they made the miniseries based on the idea that brothers in arms will have lifelong connections. And it doesn't matter if it's World War II, it doesn't matter if it's Vietnam, it doesn't matter if you're talking about the American Revolution. I mean, any war, when you have guys that are together, you know, it's not just in war. I mean, it could also just be, you know, an army unit that's together. It's the same thing.
And it's called trauma bonding. Trauma bonding. And truthfully, it is, you know, it could be in combat, but also when you go through a really tough thing like basic training or just living together, it's called trauma bonding.
Okay.
And you know, on a side note, as an actor, this is what actors love about shooting and being on set, principal photography, because you are together in like this stressful situation and you become a family really quick. Back me up here, John. It's true.
Yeah. Yep.
You become a family. And so all of a sudden you have this closeness in a really short period of time where you've got this family for however long you're shooting and you become really close. You've known these people 2 or 3 days, but you have these emotional bonds. That's why actors get in relationships with each other. This is my theory. You know, you are emotional people. You've brought these emotions out and now you're like these raw nerves or whatever. And you get to know each other on an intimate level. And when you leave, you're like popped out of a family and you're alone.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And
very interesting.
So it's true in the acting world.
Yeah. Right. So Corey, I have a question for you about that then. You know, did you bond with anyone on the set of Saving Private Ryan that you're still in touch with?
No, it wasn't there long enough really to bond with anybody.
You didn't have any trauma bonding from that movie.
No. I just there were guys. Look, there was a guy who was a spark. He was an electrician. His name was Dave. And there have been about 3 or 4 movies that I've worked on that I found out he was working on. And I would just see him somewhere and I'd go, Dave? He'd go, hello, Corey. And I was like, dude, we got to play some golf. And he's like, okay, let's go play some golf. We played golf in Ireland. We played golf, I think, once in Malta. A couple other places, you know. Yeah, you know. So that I was always. Interesting. Christian, I'm such a theater animal that I never really felt like I was completely at home on a film set. And I have watched actors with jealousy who I know are very, very comfortable on a film set. Ed Burns was one of them. Ed Burns, he grew up on a film set. You know, he became who he was. Right. On his film set. And within a few years of the brothers McMullen coming out, he was in Private Ryan. He did other things. You know, he's working
with
all these great
people. He gets second billing in this movie. You know
what?
He gets second billing in this movie. That already says something.
Yeah. Well, and he was huge, you know, he told us a story about, when the brothers McMullen that was his first one. He was working in the mailroom at ICM in Los Angeles. And on a Friday evening, he drove to Sundance.
Wow.
Because the brothers McMullen was showing on Saturday afternoon, you know? So he drove to Sundance and crashed in his car. He got up. He went to check the theater. He did such and such. The movie played. He came back, hey, good. And the next day, they have a thing where you go and sit in a room behind a desk, and people come and say, I really liked your movie. Here's my card. Get in touch. And he went, okay. And so he goes there, and there's like a line of people coming out of the door, and he's going, well, someone hit it big. He goes and sits down. They're for him.
Wow.
He said maybe 150 industry people went, you've got to get in touch with me. I absolutely loved your movie. We got to talk. And it's all for him. He said the only reason he went back to the mailroom on one day was to resign. You know, he said, I'm done.
Wow.
And I think he then went upstairs and met with half a dozen agents at ICM, and they pitched him what they were going to do for him. So in a weekend, his life changed.
Wow.
And that's getting thrown up. That's being born on a film set. I'm used to working in theater, and I've also learned how to pull back, because you can't anymore. You invest yourself in the role and what you're doing. You can't anymore invest yourself into people because of that. You know, these guys were traumatized, and I'm not in any way comparing what we do to what they did. They were traumatized from doing it that one time.
Yeah.
If I'm lucky, I'm going to do 6 or 8 jobs a year. I can't go through that 6 or 8 times.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. You do have to learn how to protect
yourself.
Just
learn to protect yourself. So,
yeah.
You know,
you,
it's not
you
as
do, you
glamorous
did
in
make
that way.
friends. You did make some friends on Band of Brothers, didn't you?
Well, sure. There are people on Band of Brothers who I still talk to every once in a while. Ross McCall, Tom Hardy was on Band of Brothers. But
You played
because
Jared.
I worked with Tom in Black Hawk Down, and I also did a movie called The Code with him and Robert Forster about 5 or 6 years after Band of Brothers. That was right around the time we were doing The Code that Tom said, yeah, I've been offered this role and I've got to gain 50 pounds of muscle for it. And I said, dude, you can't do that in 2 months. He said, oh, yeah, I can't. Don't worry about it. And he sends me these pictures of himself, and he's all like this. And I went, holy cow, man. He's bald with a mustache. It was Bronson. You know, that was the movie that made him.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know so much crap. I can't even believe it. It's
I'm a
crazy.
Font. I'm a font of crap.
Right. So then we get a shot with Ed Burns and Matt Damon. The two of them are sitting there also waiting for the tanks to show up.
Well, I love that, where they look at each other. That's that knowing look of like, we've gone through all this. Guys have died. I've not wanted to do this, but now, you know, I think, you know, you didn't want to leave. I have respect for you, man. All right.
And
he
gives him a nod of approval at the time. So
right.
it's great.
Yeah. I'm over my anger. We're in this together. Let's do this.
That's
right. And then the shot changes, and we see the guys in their foxholes. We see, Mike in front of them, also just to give us their perspective of the street, waiting for, you know, the tanks to finally show up. And
you can hear them, but you can't see them.
That's right. And then you see a whole bunch of German soldiers just scuttle across the screen, in the
walking
distance.
Along. And then behind them.
And then behind them comes the tank.
Right.
And I mean, this is just done so well, because it really gives us the anticipation that these characters are having, you know, and it puts us there that we're also anticipating. We're waiting. Okay, we know that the tank is supposed to turn down the street, and then you see the tank just passes by them.
Yeah.
And, you know, at this point, Miller just says, Panzer didn't take the bait. You know, he knows that his plan just didn't work of what he wanted. He
it
doesn't
was a
yet
shot.
Know. That's right.
Right. No.
And then he looks up at Jackson up in the bell tower, you know, trying to get some sort of an idea. And I mean, Christian, I think you mentioned this at the beginning. He's basically also, he's looking for Jackson for help, but he's also looking up into the heavens, asking for some sort of divine help, you know, with what they have to do here, because he knows that
I think that
really
was John.
In...
I mean, Corey.
Oh, Corey said it. I don't remember which one he said. Sorry.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's just one of those things. I mean, we do a lot of things. We things, you know, it's like they say, the reason something is a cliche is that it's true. You know, you don't, a cliche doesn't become a cliche because it's bullshit. It becomes a cliche because it's the truth. And the idea of doing this and looking up, and you go, I'm not certain if I can't remember ever in my life looking up to look for God or a God. But I know you look up to kind of go and to get like a breath in you. You know, you don't look down. You look, there's something, it's like when you look to the right, you're thinking with the left side of your brain. When you look to the left, you're thinking with the right side of your brain. There are indicators that we have. And I think it's one of those lovely artistic kind of moments that he looks up. But there's always a practical reason for us looking up. We never just simply go, God, it's me, Margaret, where are you? You know,
That's
you go, there's a reason for him looking up. And it just works in two two ways. That's the beauty of a movie, is it's never completely practical. It's always ever so slightly. There's an artistic license that comes into play that gives us, again, it's the luxury of being able to think in a way those men aren't able to think. You know, we can say, oh, look, he's invoking the deity there. And it's like, no, I'm hoping the sniper can shoot the tank. You know, that's what I'm
That's right.
hoping, you know,
That's right.
really.
Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective with these type of things.
Which is, you know, but it's what's brilliant about it. You know, it's like, and you know, talking of another war movie that he made, Schindler's List, he took a real chance shooting the scenes in, like, one of the scenes where the little girl is walking around and she's got a red coat on. Everything else is in black and white except you see this red coat. He took a real chance because it's such an obvious thing to do. And it calls attention to itself as a trick of the cinema. But in that moment of the movie, you believe that what was going on is that's the only clean bit of colored clothing in this entire city, because everything else was so oppressively gray and oppressively dirty and oppressively downtrodden that this poor little girl walking around in what looked like a gray red coat was the only bit of vibrancy left. And it,
Correct.
so it worked not only practically, but it worked as a metaphor in the movie, which, I mean, I think is why, you know, one of the reasons why he's, you know, ostensibly one of the greatest, certainly in the top five filmmakers of all time, you
Correct.
know. And that's a heady list because, you know, you've got some great, every decade, another five come out and you go, well, these men are geniuses, you know. But it's like Steven has stood kind of the test of time. You know, where his movies become more beautiful. Even the early ones become more beautiful. You find more things in them. You never look at Jaws and go, yeah, you can really see the wheels turning there. You can see the gaps. There were no gaps. You look at the bit where they find the shark tooth and you go, that was shot in a swimming pool? And you go, yes, it was. Shot in a swimming pool. Because he didn't have the studio time or the money to shoot it properly, so he did what he could and he makes it work. You don't see the joins with him, which is why he's brilliant.
For sure. All right, so we've made it through this minute. So let's do today's segment.
Miracle. A
Yeah.
miracle.
It's been fascinating. Don't get me wrong. So
I don't know if this is better or worse than the last one we were on, but anyway, go on.
So every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests, because it's two of you, will give me their top five John Williams movie scores themes. So I think the best way to probably do this is just do it in snake fashion. So Christian, why don't you start off with your number five, and then Corey will give us his five, and then his four, and then your four. We'll just quickly go through that in snake fashion.
All right, my number five, Harry Potter.
Oh my God, we're just going to do this one up. You're not going to explain why it's great?
You can if you want, whatever you
Yeah,
prefer.
why? Just yeah, give me some stuff about Harry Potter.
I mean, you're asking me to give you, like, I mean, I have
Why
to,
do you like it?
why do I like it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I like all of these because they stick with you,
Yeah.
right? I
Yeah.
mean, they stick with
Yeah.
you know instantly when you hear it what it is.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no question. And that's the thing with all of these that I'm going to tell you. And with John Williams tunes,
Yeah.
they are just so iconic that you hear them instantly and you know what movie that is, and it puts you right in the middle of the movie. Like, it's not just you hear a song, but you
Yep.
hear the theme song, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of the movie. Like, you're in the middle of the feeling of the
Yep.
movie. I can hear the Harry Potter theme song, and I can all of a sudden feel like the feelings of
Yep.
Hogwarts.
Yep.
You feel the magic.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I hate putting them. I hate putting them in a list of preference. So I'm gonna try and go in some kind of chronological order. So, I mean, my number five would be
Chronological. That's crazy. I don't know how you can do that.
well, but because I'm going early when I first recognized who did that? It was there. I don't think there's been a theme that is more singularly evocative of a movie than the theme from Jaws.
Of course. So you would put that as your number five?
See, I started with number five.
I know. Because it's the first one. Because I'm going to go and I'm going to say, look, you write two notes. He wrote two notes. Ba-dum. And then he basically went bum 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 with every once in a while going bum 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 bum. And then he added a couple of things, but it will always bum 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 bum. And that was it. That was the movie. But you can't hear that. It's not even a song.
He's breaking the rules. He's breaking the rules.
But there are themes. But that to me is the most complete and perfect.
Okay, so he's giving his number. One, that's I gave my number five. Now
that's
what?
My number five. That's my number five.
It is number five. Okay, go to your number four. Go to your number four.
Me?
No, it's you. You do. Yeah, no, Corey. Now it's you.
Oh, my number four. Superman. And I will say not only the overture to Superman, because there are moments in the movie where you hear the brilliance of his soundtrack, like this is what he does through his scores. He when he shows the planet Krypton, you come up on Krypton from space and you see the planet and you see the way the buildings are and how striking they are. And all he plays is da da ba 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 ba. And he plays it different. He plays it. There's a different undertone to it. And by the time he gets to the final phrase, bum, 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 there's something else that has happened that tells an entire story.
Right.
And that's why he's brilliant. You know, and look, you've got the Superman theme as well. Bum, 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 bum. That's evocative of Superman. It's brilliant.
Right.
And Can You Read My Mind, the love theme from Superman, is also brilliant. But those moments, the things like that, they don't leave you. And so you hear the overture of that and you get all of them. And you go back when you hear it after the movie, you go back and you go, oh my God, that was a beautiful moment. So you remember the movie as well. You
yes.
know? Because it's mm-hmm. just... It, locks you in.
Perfect. Yeah. All right, Christian, your turn, number four.
So I'm going to have Corey describe my movies because he also puts the song in there. So, okay, Corey, my number four is Jurassic Park. So why don't you describe why my number four would be Jurassic Park? Why is it so great?
Obviously, because it's not just, how do you evoke a dinosaur? You can't. But it's the way, and this is just my opinion. There are things in the theme, because this would have been my number three. There are things in the theme that evoke a kind of a, it reminds me, if I was going to sum it up in a phrase, it would be the return of the king.
I feel like it's so big. Like when I hear it, like, you know how the gates in Jurassic Park are
so
big?
Yeah.
And like, you know, and the dinosaurs are so huge.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the beginning of that music is just so big.
Yes.
That's
just kind
of like that.
But the way it starts from something so small where it just goes, ba-da-da, and it just builds onto something else. And by the time he gets to the thing, by the time he gets to the phrase, ba-da-da, this is the brilliance of John Williams. Ba 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 ba. I'm gonna do it wrong. Ba 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 ba. That's not what he did. He goes ba 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 ba. And it's just like, oh man, just a little tiny moment like that of making you. He grabs you and picks you up to their level and says, "Go on, live with them, see what they are." You know, that's what makes him a genius.
That's true.
Yeah. Wow.
All right.
Okay, you're number three, Christian.
Yeah, I got out of the sequence, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, Catch Me If You Can.
Wow, good choice.
First of all...
You're just a jazz fan.
Yeah. I love the jazz. I love the movie. Like, it's going to be on my Steven Spielberg, like...
Hey, don't give it away.
Sorry. I love the movie. I absolutely adore the movie. And so the music to me puts you right in the time of the, you know, right in the time period of the film. And so that for me, it sets the stage and it's really unique. So that's why I love it. John could probably elaborate better than me.
No. I was just going to say, you know, the whole thing, again, just the fact that, you know, the thing it tells you about the character is that this guy was literally flying by the seat of his pants. And there's something about a knowledge he gained and used maybe before he completely owned the knowledge, which there's something about jazz that is like that. Where right. you can be a great musician, but jazz is encouraging you not to live where you know. It's not to live where you know, but to attempt to live in places you're not aware of yet. Right. And so, you know, that's how you grow as an artist, is by, you know, expanding that.
You know, there's this wonderful line in La La Land where you know, Sebastian is trying to teach Mia like the beautifulness of jazz. And he's like, you know, he takes her to this jazz club and he's like, look, you know, you see this guy? He's right now taking over. He's like taking over. He's like grabbed it. And he's now like, you know, and now he's fighting for the, you know, the stage and he's trying to take over. And, you know, and that is the wonderfulness of jazz, is that, you know, you never know what's going to happen and somebody can like take it and run with it. And that is what happens in Catch Me Within, you know, when you can, is that. You know, the main character, you never know what he's going to do. And he's always stealing stuff. So.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Go on.
Corey, your number three, you said, is Jurassic Park, right?
My number three is Jurassic Park.
Okay. So what's your number two then?
My number two is Schindler's List.
Ooh.
And the reason it's number two, there's.
Oh, because chronologically it came out the same year as.
I was saying vague, it was vague chronological, but the reason it's number two is there are very few movies nowadays that are made where you have a composer. People just take pop songs and put them in because they're a cheap, quick way of getting to the emotional content of a scene. They indicate to the audience exactly where they should be in order to experience this scene. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they play, you know, a pop song and it tells people, oh, that was 1978 or I was 10 or I was 15 or I was 22 or whatever. And it's about this. And so I know that's because it parallels what they're going through. Okay, so I'm good. But it's a layer of separation. There's one guy writing today. And I want to say it's the guy who did Meet Joe Black. It's like Thomas Newton or something.
No.
Thomas Newton Howard.
It's not Thomas Newton. It's
there are things he uses. There are phrases he uses that are dissonant. They don't play nicely with one another. The notes don't play nicely. He does it on purpose, and he doesn't do the thing you expect. He goes off on 90-degree angles in his music, and it's the only
Randy
way to.
Randy Newman.
No.
Randy.
No.
No. No. No. No. No.
No. No. No. No. And the only way to describe it is agonizing.
Thomas Newman.
The only way to describe it is agonizing. His chord choices and the way he layers notes on top of one. I could play phrases for you that it's agony to listen to. He's doing it not because of what's going on in the scene. Of course, what's going on in the scene isn't agonizing, but his music is telling you things about the people that you don't know from seeing what they're experiencing. Schindler's List just underscores the experience, but does it in the most beautifully horrifying way. Because he asked him to write the score, and he said, "Well, I'd love to have a look at the movie." And he showed him the movie, and he said, "I can't write music to this. You've got to get someone else to do it." He said, "Well, I would, but the guys who are better than you are all dead." You know, meaning you're the only person alive who can write this, and that's why he's as great as he is, because, you know, down the line he was probably the only person alive who could have written these scores, you know.
Wow,
he's that good.
Yes. All right, Christian, what's your number two?
Okay, well, we're gonna have to skip my number two and go to my number one because number two is Jaws, so I'm gonna give you my number
Well,
one.
you don't, you're skipping it. You just have to tell me what it is, and you don't have to then
Why
explain
though? Why do you like Jaws?
Well, I mean, same reason you like Jaws, so I'm not gonna re-describe it. You know, it's just iconic, super scary, and it's a, the same reason. Two
Yeah.
notes.
Yeah.
In fact, it's so scary, I never seen it.
Oh, wow.
I've seen
Come on.
scenes. I've seen scenes.
Oh my
I was a
God.
little kid and I was so scared by the music and the picture of the poster and the commercial. I would never go see it, so I've never seen
Okay.
it.
Can I just
Wow.
say we're talking about the music, so I'll just talk about the music. There is a point when they realize they're on the trail of this shark, and John Williams writes chase music that
Yes.
makes you think they're going to get him. This is great. They're going to get him. And they don't know, and you don't either, what it is they're up against.
Correct.
And when you discover what they're up against, the music disappears. There's no, I mean, maybe
It
I'm
disappears at
wrong.
the point where the shark goes back under the water.
The,
The shark
right.
goes under the
It,
water and
the
then the
music
music.
goes under the water with him. After the Indianapolis speech, there's very little music,
Correct.
you know? And it's just like that's the
Yeah,
last 20
I mean
minutes of the movie.
that's what I mean is silence. When you have a great composer and you have a good director that knows how to use the silence of no
Right.
music,
Not
like
afraid of the silence. Yeah.
yeah, that is
Well,
I actually
look at this movie, Saving Private Ryan. Most of the movie does not have a score.
Yeah.
You know, there's a few
Right.
there are moments that have it, and then the
Right.
end. You know, there's
Because it was important to have the sound.
yes, of
It
course.
was important to have the noise. And it wasn't like all explosions and all. It was like the tanks coming from a long way off. And this was something that was created because people have said you fire a bullet into water and the bullet almost immediately stops. It doesn't keep going through. You can't get killed by a bullet underwater. And I was going, huh.
Sure you can.
Yeah, you can get killed. I because a
Now,
lot of people in Pearl
in the
Harbor
movie,
died that way. Yeah.
right.
But
In the
you
movie,
know,
we see people getting killed
yeah,
that way.
there were guys who were saying, yeah, you just can't, and the bullets don't travel through water like that. They weave and they, you know, they turn like fish, but
Well,
they're slowing down exponentially.
they slow down, but they still can kill you underwater. And I will say that I really struggled with this movie
Jaws.
score thing in my own film because you can overscore a movie and it
Yes.
overtakes the film. And you also have to figure out you can underscore it as well. So that was very difficult for me to figure out where that nuance. And I think if I could critique that film on anything, I think I overscored it a little. And if I was going to go back and do anything, I would probably remove a little bit of the score in a couple of places. Not much, just a tad. And so yeah, that it is hard to get comfortable with the silence in a movie. So the master stroke of what he did there in Jaws is amazing. So now can I go to my number one?
Yes,
Yeah.
you can.
What do you think it is?
Same as mine.
What'd you say?
Same as mine.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Star Wars.
Mean, how could it not be?
Yeah, it's got to be. Yeah.
I mean,
You didn't just go in chronological order.
No, I can't. I said that as a ruse.
Yeah, I
It
mean,
was.
it just has to be Star Wars. You know, you just because it was the movie, of course, was so revolutionary during that time. The score had to be as well. Like, I mean, there's just nothing
Correct.
like it, you know.
They made those movies. Lucas made Star Wars around the same time Spielberg was making Close Encounters. And they were on a beach in Hawaii at one point before Star Wars came
Know
out.
this? How do you know
I
these
just
things?
read it. I read it.
That's when they thought of Indiana Jones.
And they, yeah. And they, but they were both going, well, this is going to be horrible, man. We're never going to make movies again, you know? And they didn't know, you know? I mean, not that Star Wars made Close Encounters possible because they're very different movies, but Close Encounters built on what Star Wars had made possible. You know, I think without Star Wars, Close Encounters would have been a niche movie, and instead it became one of the titles of the 70s, you know?
We did
All right.
it.
Yeah. Thank you both
And I
very
mean,
much.
look, Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, that's a
That's right.
great theme as well. Yeah.
Yes. For
But there
sure.
you go.
All right. Well, thank you both for those lists. So, Christian, do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Yes, absolutely. Well, my production company is Documentary First Productions. So that's documentaryfirst.com. And you can find me there, my movie's there. And if you want to write me, ask more questions, Christian at documentaryfirst.com.
All right. And Corey, how can people get in touch with you if they want
They can't. No one can get
to?
in
Okay,
touch with me.
that's fine
You just got
also.
to take a shot. You turn on, if you're up after 2 a.m. and you're watching an obscure television channel, you'll probably see me walk across your screen this
You can look him up on IMDb and you can see his huge list of credits.
Watch Midnight Caller. It's on, I think it's on Amazon Prime, Apple TV. It's streaming right now in America. So Midnight Caller. It's a movie that was made in 2020. I think it was released in 2024. So it's not the TV series with Gary Cole, but it
Right.
is about a disc jockey. So,
Yeah, that's his latest one.
yeah,
So,
guess who
all right,
plays the
yeah, go.
disc jockey?
Go check that out.
Yeah.
Also, all my social medias are documentary first. So you can check that out. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter.
All
You can
right.
hit me up
And
there.
finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this.
Earn
Yes.
this.
Solitude. You.